In the Studio with Bob Reed and Blair Peckham is brought to you in part by Long & McQuaid, where the music begins. Rent, buy, or rent to own at their six GTA locations.
Welcome to In the Studio, the program where we talk about music, the world of music, people who make it, and all things related to it. Hello again, Blair Peckham.
Hello, Bob Reed.
Lots to talk about this week.
Yes.
And people to talk with.
Yes.
Stephen Page is one of them. We are going to connect with him before this hour is out, live from a Via Rail train. Does it get more Canadian than that, I ask?
That's right. He's sipping maple syrup as he rolls along. The new album that Stephen has made is really fantastic. Heal Thyself, Part 1, Instinct. It's a sort of longish title for a bunch of fantastic pop songs.
Yeah, it's a weighty title, but the material's not. I mean, it's certainly got some depth to it.
Oh, yeah.
But it's very easy on the ears.
You know, people, when they hear me say pop music, often misunderstand me. Pop music gets a bad rap. When I say pop, I just mean good songs. So for me, the umbrella of pop music is huge. And Stephen Page is certainly under that umbrella, because these songs they're catchy, they're melodic, they're thoughtful, they're as you say, they've got some depth to them. They're somewhat confessional. The production is fantastic by our friend Craig Northey. It's a great package.
Also a great package is the new release from local singer-songwriter Corin Raymond. He's a fixture at the Cameron House and has been for many years there. Has a great title. Hobo Jungle Fever Dreams is the new release. And not only are they terrific songs and it's a great sounding record, this package, this CD package, is something else.
It's super deluxe. The booklet is 80 pages. Yeah. There's so much information on it, and just beautiful artwork. It's gorgeous. It really is. And Corin, you know, in case, you know, if you haven't heard of Corin Raymond and you're listening to this show and you're thinking, why should I care about this guy? Well, if you like good music, I know some of you do. This guy writes a beautiful lyric. It's, you know, it's in the tradition of, I don't know, Johnny Cash and John Prine are two names that come up when people talk about him. And it's like that. It's that kind of quality. It's really fantastic.
Sure is. And he's a good interview, too. So Corin Raymond coming up on the show today as well. But we've got to start off by, last week we touched briefly on the loss of Sir George Martin, the producer of the Beatles through so much, almost their entire recording career. And one of the absolute greats, one who will leave a lasting legacy on the craft of studio recording, without a doubt. And last week we just had a chance to touch briefly on his passing, but now we're able to, just because of circumstances, we're able to go a little deeper, and we'd be remiss if we didn't. So it's always impossible to sum up somebody's entire career impact briefly, but as we touched on last week, the Beatles wouldn't have been the Beatles that we all know and love, and the Beatles wouldn't have been the recording act that they were, if not for George Martin.
There's no doubt about that. Well, first of all, the Beatles, because of the commercial success they achieved, I mean, if you're sort of putting the chicken before the egg or whatever, they had this incredible cultural influence because of that success. But what gave them that success were the ideas that they had in conjunction with their producer, who was able to spot this magic in the first place. Their influence will continue, but it's his specific influence on their recordings, which has changed really the technology of recording to this day in every genre.
For people who hear the title producer and might not be sure what that means, help unpack it. He's the equivalent of the director of a feature film, right? He's like the guy in charge working with the talent. You know, the movie parallel. He's coaching the actors. He's working with the script that he's been given and trying to bring it to life in the most impactful and appropriate for what they're trying to do way. Does that make sense?
Yep, that's fair. I remember when I was a kid and my dad bought Sgt. Pepper. And so there we had it at home, and I listened to it incessantly. And I'd had a bunch of Beatle records up until that point. But this record was mind-boggling, and it had a producer credit on it, and it said, produced by George Martin. But a producer is a person who will watch over the budget, who will liaise with the record company, who will oversee the technical and the musical aspects of the recording. Sometimes it's as simple as capturing a recording, and other times it's shaping a recording. And certainly George Martin was more of the latter. Even though the Beatles were a great live act, as they developed into more of a studio animal, he was there for them at every turn, and he was able to help them with new techniques, with new ideas, all down the line.
Or just new approaches. Here's an example from very, very early in the Beatle career, their first big hit, and how George Martin's influence took what Lennon and McCartney had in mind for this particular song and turned it into something different and something eminently successful as a result.
So George Martin says, well, have you got anything you'd like to do? We said, we've got a song called Please Please Me. This is one John had just written. And it was kind of slow Roy Orbison kind of thing. Come on, dum, dum, come on, please, please me. Big note at the end, just like Orbison.
And I'd heard Roy Orbison doing Only the Lonely or something, and I was trying to please me. That's where that came from. And also, I was always intrigued by the words of please lend your little ears to my please, Bing Crosby song. Mm-hmm. I was always intrigued by the double use of the word please.
And I said, okay, we'll give it a whirl. Let's try your song. Let's see if it works. And at the end of that session, I was able to say to them, you got your first number one. Great.
And he was right. It was their first number one.
Yes.
Now, would it have been if they'd gone with the Roy Orbison-esque approach? Who knows?
Right. Hard to know. But, you know, simple things. You know, the Boys of Summer?
Mm-hmm.
Boys of Summer was originally a semitone down on the original recording. And everybody, like the people who heard it, you know, it's the Don Henley song, of course, written by the bed track written by Mike Campbell. But when he decided to recut it a semitone higher, it
just
was magic.
Popped. Yeah. Well, this leads well into another example here from what was the first song that was originally going to be part of Sgt. Pepper.
Yeah.
And as we all know, was released as an interim single. I'm talking about Strawberry Fields, of course, along with Penny Lane. And George Martin took two different approaches to that song and with some tweaking along the lines of what you just talked about, turned it into something else.
And on Monday, we tackled it again, quite differently. John decided he wanted it in lower key. It had an introduction for the first time, which was played on that weird instrument, the mellotron, and became a really key feature. And it started with the chorus rather than the verse. Strawberry Fields immediately, isn't it?
Let me take you down.
Double track voice right away. Again, all the rhythm instruments on one track. The voices on three and four.
Nothing to get hung about.
But John thought about it and said, I think I can do it better than that. He said, I wanted to have a bit more bite in it. Brass, strings. So I say, okay, let's give it a whirl.
Let me take you down, cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields.
Double track voices on three and four, but with percussion as well on three.
Nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever.
Suor Mandela. An Indian instrument that George had brought back, like a kind of harp. They have a marvellous effect. Backward cymbal on track one. Always sounds like Russian language to me. Brass stabs and so on, and with the cello. But underlying it all, this wonderful rhythm section. About 9 or 10 players.
Strawberry Fields forever. Strawberry Fields forever. Strawberry Fields forever.
It sounds so weird hearing that second approach
yes.
to it, because Lennon sounds like he's on helium, because that was the original speed in a different key. It's at least a
yes.
semitone higher from the original kick.
Correct, yeah.
And then to meld both parts, because Lennon really loved both approaches and George Martin liked both of them as well, they had to square that circle.
They slowed down the main body of the song, which is the latter thing that we heard,
yeah.
and they sped up the first part of the song. So at pretty much precisely 1 minute into the song, there's an edit.
Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to strawberry fields. Nothing is real.
And there it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can hear it. I mean, they're now in the same key because they've met somewhere in the middle. It's why if you're trying to play guitar along with it or piano, it's
yeah.
not quite.
Good luck.
It's between the keys.
Just another example, though, of how George Martin was able to roll with the ideas of the Beatles and bring them to life, to surprise them sometimes, to take them in a different direction from where they wanted to go, or to unpack the seeds of the vision or the notion that they had and really bring it to life and make it what it was.
Absolutely.
So just a couple of brief examples. There are so many of how important Sir George Martin was to the success of the Beatles and to the impact that they had, not only as a cultural phenomenon, but on recording music and recording music techniques to this day. We'll take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about Brian Johnson of AC/DC and the tragedy of Keith Emerson when In the Studio returns. Welcome back to In the Studio. Bob Reed and Blair Packham with you. And to me, the signature recorded performance by Keith Emerson, that synthesizer part coming out of the end of Lucky Man, that was one of the first really mass successful singles that utilized synthesizer technology. Not necessarily the first, but a classic example of it, and demonstrated his talent, his virtuosity as a keyboard player.
Absolutely. He was revered as a keyboard player, in fact, and as a showman too. But yeah, it was his keyboard prowess. Prog rock geeks everywhere loved Keith Emerson and what Emerson, Lake and Palmer brought to the table. I think actually it's funny, Lucky Man was those same fans wouldn't have liked Lucky Man so much. It was like a pop single.
Yeah.
You know, they liked the longer form pieces.
Keith Emerson very tragically took his own life last week. At the age of 71, it was officially ruled a suicide very quickly. We're hearing different things. He suffered from depression. He had a bit of a drinking problem. But his longtime girlfriend also commented on how a number of years back he'd suffered nerve damage in one of his hands, and it was significantly affecting his ability to play. And he had an upcoming tour planned in Japan that was literally keeping him up at night. She said he was so concerned about potentially not being able to deliver to the best of his abilities, or the best of his abilities being less than what his fans would be looking for and be hoping for. And she said he read a lot of comments on the internet from his most recent public performances that were very negative. And, you know, it's real easy to spout off behind the anonymity of a keyboard and a computer screen, and a lot of people did, and it really cut Keith Emerson deeply. And it seems like being trolled to death might have been part of a factor in what made him take his own life.
It does seem like that, and it really truly makes it into a tragedy. It's one thing when someone kills themselves because of the various problems they have, but when they're spurred on by the cruelty of other people, I think it's truly tragic.
We've seen this, you know, I think of the Rattaya Parsons case and others where, nasty kids on the internet will get on someone to the point where it pushes them to do the unthinkable. It's not just nasty kids. This has an impact on adults. It has an impact on everybody, and so it's doubly tragic and doubly maddening to think that, you know, that would have been part of what made Keith Emerson decide to take that step that he did. But he will certainly be missed. Carl Palmer is already saying that he's going to put a tribute show together in his honor and in his memory, and so we'll look forward at least to that, to there being a proper musical celebration of the life and legacy of the late, great Keith Emerson, one of a kind. Elsewhere in the world of music, Brian Johnson has been the lead singer of AC/DC for, what, well over 30 years, I guess.
Yes, you know, I would say so.
Since the death of Bon Scott. And he's been having some medical issues, particularly with hearing. And it was announced earlier this month that Brian Johnson had been told by his doctors that he faced total hearing loss if he continued touring with the band. That prompted a hiatus in tour plans. Then suddenly there was talk coming from elsewhere in AC/DC that, yeah, we're going to look at using special guest performers to sing live with us on the road. And that had people going, whoa, wait a minute. First of all, how do you fill in for a voice like that, which is so unique?
Yes.
And secondly, where do you just find people who might be capable of singing like that? And third, who'd want to see it? So there were a lot of concerns in the AC/DC fan base. But now what we're hearing is Brian Johnson sat down with a friend of his whom he trusts very much for a podcast interview. And he's saying that he feels kicked to the curb by the rest of the band, that there have been developments that have caught him completely by surprise. He said in this interview that he called and let the band know, hey, this is what the doctor said, but let's try and figure this out. Didn't say he wanted to quit, didn't say that he was incapable of carrying on. And then within 2 days, he read in the papers and saw on social media that the tour is being canceled and there's talk of guest singers coming in. And then he said all of his tour luggage turned up in his driveway one day shortly after that, without a call, without any communication from the band. And as he said, no, how's your hearing? How's your health? What's going on? Boom, here's your stuff. He chose a different word. Nice to know you. And Johnson told this interviewer that he believes Angus Young, who's 7 years younger, wants to continue with AC/DC for another decade and fears Johnson's hearing issues would stand in the way of those plans. And so, as I said, he says he feels completely kicked to the curb by all of this. No official comment that we've seen yet from AC/DC, but this is an acrimonious situation.
It really is. You know, you and I, Bob, we're modern men. We're sensitive and we're touchy-feely. And
right.
If you and I, well, this has happened, though. If you and I have a problem, we talk about it, you know. Clearly, these Aussies aren't like that.
AC/DC are not a kind and gentle, nurturing bunch. Whether, is that what you're suggesting?
Whether that suggests that we're more evolved or that we're more weak-willed or something like that, I don't know what it suggests, but the whole situation suggests there's not a lot of communication going on in that band.
No. Now, we've seen situations like this before, and what comes to mind was the INXS situation with J.D. Fortune, where he said, we finished a tour, and it was like, great job, lads, see you next round, and then he never got called again. That can happen, I guess, with a new replacement player. Or Billy Joel's longtime band got very upset when suddenly they heard that he was going on tour with a bunch of other guys, not including them. These things happen. And again, there's a situation where you've got one guy who's the main guy who actually hires and pays the salaries of everybody else. So you could say, okay, fine, fair deal. That's his purview if that's what he wants to do. AC/DC has been a band in every sense of the word through their entire career, and as long as Brian Johnson's been part of it. So it's doubly surprising, I think, to see something like this playing.
I agree. Yeah, it's just weird.
We will shift gears onto happier stuff and get to some guests when we come back after this break. Corin Raymond joins us. He is a Toronto fixture, and he's got a fantastic new record out. We'll tell you about that back after this on In the Studio.
I'm hard on my body, I'm hard on my bones. hard on every tool I own. Hard of hearing, I'm hard of taste. Getting all my teeth replaced. I'm hard on every tool I use. I strip the drivers and the screws. I'm hard on my soles, hard on my heels. Hard on tires, I'm hard on wheels. Hard on clutches, I'm hard on brakes. I'm hardest on my own mistakes. And my suspension needs new springs. Cause I'm hard on things. Yeah, I'm hard on things.
Welcome back to In the Studio. Bob Reed and Blair Packham with you, and that's music from our next guest. Corin Raymond is his name. Hasn't been in with us for a while, but he's got a brand new album out that's really something. It's called Hobo Jungle Fever Dreams, and it's produced by David Gillis. Corin is a local rascal indeed. That's the name of his record label, which we think is cool. Longstanding fixture at the Cameron House here in Toronto. I guess, Corin, it was... Was it when There Will Always Be a Small Time came out the last time we sat down? I think
that was it. Yeah, yeah, that would have been 2009.
Wow.
That's a while.
It's been far too long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But good to see you again. And I mentioned the Cameron House. I know for a long time you were an artist in residence there. Is that still the case?
That's still going. Yeah? I mean, I'm touring through April and won't be back there till May. But when I go back in May, we do a Thursday 6 to 8 matinee. And that'll mark 11 years of Thursdays at the Cameron House.
That's great. Tell us about the new record and the themes on it. Blair hears a lot of John Prine in the writing and in the songs. I hear a little Johnny Cash in that one we just heard a bit of, Hard on Things. I think there's some of that in there. How are we doing? Are we accurate?
So far, I see nothing wrong. yeah, I mean, you can't. I mean, if you're picking up a guitar and writing songs, you know, and you absorb a lot of John Prine at any time, I mean, if you're a healthy songwriter, that's gonna have an impact on you.
How can that be bad?
And Johnny Cash, yeah, I consider myself a troubadour in the style of Johnny Cash, and I would say of all the songs I've written over the years I've been writing, you know, I think I can name three that I believe he would have sang, you know, and Hard on Things is one of those, and so there's some channeling. Johnny Cash. Yeah. I mean, you're singing The Hard on Things is about that self-destructive spiral urge in all of us. And, you know, Johnny Cash, he knew about that, and he sang about it with authority. And, you know, I think Hard on Things is one of those tunes.
Well, that shone through when I heard it first listen. Not that you'd say, hey, is this Johnny Cash doing this? But it just had that grit. It had that little darkness to it. And I love the way the song's written. It's just a series of things that you're hard on. Your wallet, your liver.
Yeah, it's just a list, man. Yeah. I mean, I like songs like that, you know? Bob Dylan did that, too. Those songs that were just lists just coming at you.
Yeah, the greatness of the songs on this record, and I really mean great. I mean, not just in the casual way that we now say, oh, awesome, these songs are awesome. I mean, they're great songs. These are terrific songs.
Thanks, Blair.
I expected that, so because it's you, because I'm a fan.
Oh,
but
man.
What I didn't expect was the elaborateness of the art, like of the package, of the way the record is presented. It's filled with reproductions of acrylic paintings by, what's that fella's name? It's Travis?
His name is Travis Chirook, and he lives out in Victoria, B.C. The crazy thing, Blair, is that he's a great guitar player.
Yeah.
I knew him as a guitar player.
Right.
And he plays in this kind of party band called Party on High Street, and I just knew him from the community, and he's played with me out west a number of times. And then he started posting these paintings on Facebook that he'd painted of his friends. And I was just knocked out by the colors and by these sort of psychedelic portraits. And we were starting to make this album, Hobo Jungle Fever Dreams. And yeah, it just seemed like I just wanted to reach out to him. So I reached out to him asking him to start painting some of the people involved, and it turned into this incredible project. He painted over 30 portraits, and I think we used 19 of them in the package.
Wow.
And there's spectacular.
There's not a photograph in the package at all. It's all his paintings and the other, you know, as you say, the psychedelic sort of framework in the package. It's really gorgeous. And also, I love the fact that there's so much information in it. Not just the songs themselves, but a little, you know, short explanations of the songs and the chords.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, the last three things that I've put out, I've included the chords with the songs. And I decided I'm never going to release anything that doesn't have the chords in it because, I mean, that's my world. That's what it's all about.
Yeah, people want to play. These are songs people will want to play when they hear them.
It's more than just the chords, too. Like, I'm looking at one, and it says C minor. So that's the key it's in. I'm capoed on the third fret playing an A minor shape. The chords are C minor, E flat, B flat. The shapes are A minor, C, yeah. G.
But there's also a whole explanation of the Nashville numbering system at the beginning, which is a better explanation than I've given to my music classes at Seneca College.
Thanks, Blair.
So, it's much more of a practical explanation for sure.
I consider them clues, because when I was starting to learn other people's songs, which is very important to what I do, singing other people's songs, the Nashville number system, it changed the whole game right?
Yeah.
And when
you're
playing music with other people, it's such a huge thing. And so I just wanted to plant some little clues that help me learn other people's songs.
Beautiful. Corin Raymond is in the studio with us. We're talking about his new album, Hobo Jungle Fever Dreams. And the official release, by the way, is coming up on Thursday, March 31st, here in the West End of Toronto at the Lula Lounge. Have you been to Nashville? Like singer-songwriters, so many make the pilgrimage down and go there and see what that's all about. Have you done that?
I have, and I've been there once, and I was there for 10 days, and I was hanging out with the man who's dangerous to drink with down there, and this is 11 years ago, and I was there for 10 days, and it snowed three times while I was there, and each time they thought it was the apocalypse. It was crazy, man. They got a war on snow. But I did come back with a song, and I did have that feeling, as you're talking about it being a pilgrimage, I had that feeling that if I went to Nashville for 10 days and didn't come home with a song, that they'd take my license away or something, And I wrote a song there called If Wishes Were Horses, which ended up on There Will Always Be a Small Time. Only once, and I'm hoping to go back for the Americana conference and festival in September. Nashville's great.
Nashville's all about writing with other people. Are you much of a co-writer, or are you do it all on your own guy?
Both, but with this new album particularly, it's mostly co-writes. Most of the songs, in fact, it's pretty cool because a lot of these songs were finished in different places, and I've got a co-write with a songwriter from BC and a couple from Manitoba on there, and one from North Carolina. And co-writing is great. I mean, I know you do a lot of co-writing, Blair.
Yeah, I have anyway. Yeah.
I mean, for me, it's more about necessity, though. I guess, I make a full-time living as an independent artist, which is, seven full-time jobs. And, one of those jobs is writing songs, but I don't get to make as much time for writing in my day-to-day life as I'd like to.
Yeah.
And so in recent years, in the last handful of years, some of the good songs have come out of times when I was stuck in a van with another writer for 5 weeks, or just dropping by, passing through Winnipeg, or I had a songwriter staying on my couch for a week here in Toronto, and out of these little collisions come these songs.
That's fantastic. I noticed some of them because you explain where they came from and so forth in the liner notes. Some they'll go back. There's one from I think 2003, or it was started in 2003, and then not finished till later. And I'm like that too. I have things that I sort of start, and then I'm not able to finish them. And sometimes I turn to other people and I say, please help me.
That's often the way it was with these songs. You've got songs on here, like for instance, I'm just about to go on the road with Jonathan Bird, and we got two co-writes on this album. Both of them were songs that I started and was chipping away at, carrying around with me, and showed them to Jonathan. And then, the molecules got a little hotter and things started to bounce back and forth, and we finished those songs together. So, it takes me years, man. One of my favorite songs on the album is a song that I didn't co-write. It's a song I wrote. It's about the Kensington Market. It's called Morning Glories. And, it took me 4 years to finish that song, and it was tough. And I got stuck on it, and I kept coming back to it. And I really wanted to honor the neighborhood with this song. And, there's no way I could have written it any faster. And I think it's a myth often that people write songs in an afternoon.
Well, I want to briefly ask you, Neil Young has claimed, I've heard him say it several times, he has never rewritten a song, that it just flows out of him. And I just think, not to doubt him, but I do find it hard to believe. I mean, rewriting can just be as simple as crossing out one word and replacing it with another one,
Yeah, I wasn't there for those those Neil Young sessions, so yeah, I can't comment on that. But You know, we got to go with what he says, I guess. I only know for myself, and I can only speak for myself, that I've written, I don't know, I've written just over 100 songs, I guess, in my little career. And I'd say maybe 5 of those songs were written in a single day.
Yeah. Yeah, me too.
Corn, I want to ask you about one song on the record in particular called Under the Belly of the Night. It covers off the demise of some key players in music history. It starts with the Day the Music Died plane crash in Iowa that took out Buddy Holly and Ritchie Valens and the Big Bopper. And then it goes on from there. Tell us about that song.
Well, actually, the song started with an idea I had. Well, it was just this idea of being on some back road where there was no signal from any station, there was no frequency, and kind of stumbling on a station that shouldn't be there, you know, and picking up something from the other side. And I imagined, what would you pick up if Buddy Holly was still recording and you heard this song coming from the grave, you know? And I started thinking about that in a Twilight Zone-ish kind of way. And then I just kept messing around with these sort of very old R&B chords, you know, and thinking about that. And gradually, it turned into this bigger ghost story, and Sam Cooke got involved, and Jackie Wilson showed up, and then I had my 3 ghosts. And it's really a song also about the radio and the power of the radio and the places that it goes and the ghosts that literally, you know, continue to live their lives on the airwaves and get into the cabs of cars that are, like, you know, traveling through all that darkness. And it's big, it's an epic canvas, that song.
Being able to take an idea like that and articulate it, even the way you just did.
Yep.
No surprise you're as great a songwriter as you are, Corin Raymond. Congratulations on the new record. It's called Hobo Jungle Fever Dreams, which is a great title. It's a gorgeous collection of songs, and as Blair said, this 80-plus page booklet that is a work of art
80
unto itself.
Yeah, 80 pages,
Lula Lounge, Thursday, March 31st for the official CD release, and do check him out online, corinraymond.com. Good to see you again. Thanks for coming.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks, Blair.
When we come back, we'll connect with former Bare Naked Ladies frontman Stephen Page on his brand new album, Live from a Via Rail Train. We're not making this up. Back after this in the studio.
Surprise, surprise, I understand you're shocked at getting wise. I was feeling shame, you were feeling stupid, 'cause I knew what was wrong with me long before you did. I knew what was wrong with me long before you did.
Welcome back. Bob Reed and Blair Packham with you here in the studio. And there is a sample from a record that is knocking both of our socks off. It's a brand new release from Stephen Page. It's called Heal Thyself. And the former Bare Naked Ladies co-frontman is wending his way through parts unknown on board a Via train right now. And Stephen, just right off the top, I just want to ask, how do you feel about intros like that where there's the former Bare Naked Ladies reference in there? Is that a pain, or is it just part of the business?
I think it's a fact of life. You know, it's not a lie, so I can't refute it. And you know, it's a big part of my history, so and it's something I'm proud of. I'm sure any of us who've left a band at some point want to be like Peter Gabriel and just be able to just be the artist under yourself. I'm sure that, you know, it took several Peter Gabriel albums before he became no longer former Genesis lead singer Peter Gabriel. So there's time, and I'm certainly, even if it never goes away, I'm not embarrassed by it.
Good. That's great. Yeah.
Don't reference the jitters around Blair. He just goes nuts when people do that.
Yeah.
So just watch out for that.
I have a big chip on my shoulder about that. But I want to hear about this train trip.
I headed east out to Ottawa, and then we did Ottawa and Kingston and Belleville, and on our way back. And I guess I'll probably be doing this kind of piecemeal throughout the country over the next little while. I got to tell you, it's the way to tour. You get to see the country, and it feels like you're touring in a van, except you don't actually have to do any of the driving yourself. You get off, and I play some songs for the people on the platform or in the lounge of the station. Go visit some radio stations, do that kind of thing, and then jump back on the train. It's pretty great.
Nice. Okay, let's talk about the new album, Heal Thyself, Part 1, Instinct, is the full title. And you worked with Odds frontman Craig Northey on it. Craig produced it. It sounds great and really has some cool what we interpret as audio references to the Beach Boys in places and the Beatles in others. Was that the kind of sonic vibe you guys were going for?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, I had a whole bunch of songs in bits and pieces, and I knew that they had some kind of connection to each other, but I wasn't sure quite what they were. And I had worked with Craig on my last record, and then we did some touring together. So with this, I had him come over to my place and just help me kind of finish songs off and figure out what they were and what the common threads were. And before we knew it, we were making a proper album and producing it together, and had the Odds on board as the backing band for most of it as well.
Oh, that's great.
You know, the Beatles and Beach Boys is certainly kind of the common tongue for us. And then, you know, I could bring in my own influences and so on, and he could bring in his. Between those two things, like he'll bring in Muscle Shoals and Stax and that kind of thing, and I'll bring in, you know, 80s new wave, and all of a sudden the palette is quite full.
What does Craig bring to the table in terms of the songs themselves, though, the lyrics and the melody? How much editing does he get to do?
It depends from song to song, because some of them, like, let's say a song like Here's What It Takes, was pretty well intact, but it didn't have a bridge. And that's like, you know, one of my favorite things about co-writing with anybody is I want them to supply a bridge that is a complete left turn, like that it opens up another door inside the song. And I had played him a bunch of stuff that I really liked, you know, as you often do when you're writing with someone. You spend a lot of time and you go, oh, check out this record, oh, check out this thing. And he said, well, why don't we do that? I played him some Michael Nyman stuff, the British composer, and he said, why don't we do that, some of that Michael Nyman thing where it just kind of is this circle of fifths. And I was like, okay, great, let's try that. And all of a sudden we built up this completely different bridge. A song like If That's Your Way started off as a guitar-based song that Craig had like a couple lines from to start. And the two of us sat down. I decided to sit down at the piano, which I never do. I'm not a piano player normally, and I play all over this record as kind of a way to kind of push myself. And in one sitting pretty well, we sat down and wrote this song together from scratch.
Lyrically, there's always been a kind of confessional quality to your songs. But mm-hmm. with this one, it seems there's been a confessional quality, and for the last couple of records, they're sort of self-flagellating. This one seems much less so and much more optimistic.
I'm glad you noticed that, because I think now that I've had time to take a step back from it, I've realized, you know, like, you make a record, and I don't necessarily think about what it is or what it's saying while I'm making it. But then when it's done, and you kind of have to title it, and you have to come up with artwork, and you have to start telling people about it, you have to actually come up with some answers as to what it's saying and what its point of view is. And I realized that all of the kind of the self-deprecation that has always gone through my songs seems to have a sense of release to it in a way, too. That, you know, that I often wrote songs about feeling stuck. And that doesn't mean I always felt stuck, but I always felt like that was the most interesting thing to write about. You know, we have great ups and downs in our lives, and they're not always the norm, but they're far more interesting than the norm. And it's the part of the psyche I like to write about. But here I felt like I was at a point where I could see the daylight coming in. And that was a change for me.
It's a really beautiful feeling, I think, listening to your record, because it's, I don't know, it's so positive, really, even though it's acknowledging flaws and, you know, past mistakes. The first single, the Beatlesque Surprise, Surprise, ends with the refrain, I knew what was wrong with me long before you did, before it goes into that rubber soul sort of pastiche. But who are you singing to?
You know, I we've had the debate. Even Craig and I have had that, and I thought, well, maybe I'm not supposed to say, but I think it's to both the people closest to me, and it's also to the outside world too. The sense of like feeling for a long time like you had to pretend that you were something, that I was something I wasn't. And I think a lot of people identify that. You know, I've talked about this song as a song about dealing with things like depression or anxiety. And I think a lot of people who try to cope with those kinds of things often have to put a mask on in order to pass in the outside world. And it's a great relief to not have to do that. You know, sometimes your hand gets forced and you get unmasked unwillingly. But regardless of how it happens, once it's off, it's pretty easy to be able to feel much more like yourself.
Stephen Page is on the line with us, and we're talking about his brand new release. It's called Heal Thyself, Part One, Instinct is the full title. And Stephen, I find it interesting that a minute ago you said you don't necessarily set out to make an album with a direction or with an overall concept with a small C in mind. And yet, that's a pretty, it's a very interesting title. Heal Thyself, Part One, Instinct. Sets the scene for, will there be a part two? Is this something you're going to continue in the same direction on? What do you think?
Yeah, there's absolutely a part two. And that's, you know, part of what, when Craig and I started making the record together, we were thinking about, like, what is it? You know, we ended up with a couple dozen songs. And in this day and age, you know, how do you release that? Do you release it all as one big chunk of material, or do you release it as a bunch of EPs, or two separate things? And we realized that it kind of fit best as two separate records, and the first one being Instinct and the second one being Discipline, the two parts that they're referenced in a couple of the songs on this record, both There's a Melody and No Song Left to Save Me. And that becomes the shape of the records, really. It's about, you know, learning to trust your instincts as both as a writer and as a man, but then also the discipline, you know, the things you actually learn from the people around you or the habits that you create. Those are the two things that really, when it comes to making art at least, you have to rely on both. It can't all just come from the muse, but it also can't all just be technical craftsmanship either.
No, for sure. You could have a very well-crafted, crappy song, and you know, you have some.
I like some of those, though.
Well, I do too sometimes, but you know, I'll take a heartfelt song any day, really. You mentioned, you know, in this day and age and what an artist has to do and so forth. Here you are, Heal Thyself, Part One, Instinct is released on Ole Anthem. So a giant indie publisher and a pretty powerful indie record label. But really, you're still sort of a semi-independent solo artist. How do you cut through all the cultural noise to get people to hear the record?
I wish I knew the answer to that. I mean, I just like the fact that, you know...
I was asking you for myself.
Some people Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Nobody knows what the answer is to how to reach anybody.
Yeah.
I think even top-level artists don't know how. And, you know, the nicest thing for me is when somebody like you guys says that you like it or that
it connects
you.
Yeah.
And I feel like I've done my job. Like, that's the most exciting part for me at this point.
Well, you've done well, Stephen Page. It's a terrific record. Again, it's called Heal Thyself, Part One, Instinct. And it's available, I guess, everywhere now. Can we say that safely?
Yeah, you can get it online, and if you can find a place that sells CDs, you can buy it there, too.
We've heard of them. We like those places.
Yeah.
Yeah. Stephen Page, live from a Via train. Thanks for this. It's been great fun.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Blair, can you believe it? We got to call it a show. That's
yes.
Another one in the can.
That's right.
It flies by, doesn't it?
It really does. What great conversations we had, though.
Loved it. And we'll do it again a week from now, right? We will. Thank you, Mark Tang, for technical production, making us sound so good, or as good as humanly possible with the likes of us characters.
Ah.
We'll talk music again next time we gather here in the studio. Do take care till then.